This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for December 2011. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings by a few of the poets in the current issue.
This month on the podcast, we're going to hear work by Eduardo Corral.
I thought again of that motel outside of Chicago. ¿Te acuerdas?
Alice Lyons.
Unanswered, the doors are rotting from the bottom up.
And Stephen Yenser.
What kind of name is that, in any case? Middle Eastern?
The December issue also includes poems by Dan Beachy Quick, Camille Dungy, Fanny Howe, and others. December's a Q&A issue. We've done a couple of these in the past, where poets answer our pesky questions about their poems. Don, was there somewhere you wanted to start, someone you particularly liked? Or
Well, I'm laughing because sometimes we have a few risque poems in our issues.
Oh, I know who you're starting with.
That's right. Camille T. Dungy's poem, From the First, The Body Was Dirt, is what she calls an irreverent elegy. I'll read the first few lines, and then I'll skip the middle part and go to the ending. Whose hands touched first the head of the penis, the shaft? And was it soft or shale, more rock than clay? And who pinched first into their place the small cups at the base of the ass? That's a pretty...
That's lovely, Don.
Exciting. I was getting into it there.
Yeah.
It is an elegy as well as an erotic poem. It combines those two things. Here's how it ends. You must be dead by now, though I don't know whose hands prepared you, whose fingers fingered for the first time all that dark and kinky hair. If the first body was made of dirt in order to plumb the hollow of that first throat, whose thumb first lodged inside the hinge of that first mouth to force it open, to make the tongue so it could work, who shoved inside that mouth the shit of 100,000 worms?
That's very striking writing there at the end. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's as we ask her in this issue, is there a way to combine elements from these genres, erotic poem and elegy? And she says that these are in many ways elegiac times. In other words, that there is so much death and awareness of death in the news of the world around us that she felt strongly compelled to combine these things as a kind of awareness of what's going on, an honest awareness, and as well a theatrical awareness of what's going on, because so much of what we see and hear about is so vivid that it is theatrical.
But we see it on television, right? She makes that point. It's at once vivid and distanced. We're detached from it, so we don't see these wars and things, you know, on our streets,
right,
the streets of Iraq and other places. And so our reaction to violence is at one remove. And so she says that it both enables her and limits, you know, the kind of poetry that we write. And it enables this kind of romantic elegy, but it lacks the immediacy of poets who are experiencing these things firsthand.
Well, it's interesting, too, that she is thinking about one person and extends it in the poem throughout really the whole creation story as well as everything that's happening around us now. So she's making some enormous leaps in the poem.
Yeah.
So in a way, the erotic language that the poem starts off with is actually less shocking than some of the leaps that she takes.
Yeah. She sent me an email after we took this poem and said that if she'd known that all she had to do to get in poetry was to get rid of her inhibitions and, you know, throw in some porn to her poem, she would have done it much earlier.
Advice to many of our would-be contributors.
Right. Would-be contributors, yeah. To go a different direction, the completely different direction, we've also got poems by someone we've had poems in poetry before, a woman named Linda Kuhnhart. These poems, you know, I hate to describe them before I just read you one. So let me just read you this first one. This is called Clifton Webb. And you'll need a couple of these to get the feel for them. I have to describe how this looks on the page. It's four sentences, all of exactly the same length. The first one is in regular Roman type, the second in italics, the third is underlined, and the fourth is in what looks to be Greek. I smell the blood of low-definition attorneys. I smell the blood of low-definition attorneys. I smell the blood of low-definition attorneys. Then the fourth line, you just have to imagine yourself. It's in this
sort of fake transliteration.
It turns out to be fake, right? Fake Greek. And, you know, the question is, what the hell are you going to do with a poem like this, right? This comes into your inbox, and what's going on here? And one of the things I especially love is the way she answers the question. We ask a question, you know, the last line of this poem is a faux Greek transcription of the previous lines. Why are there Greek letters? We found ourselves enjoying the humor in this poem, but couldn't quite explain how it works. Can you? Her entire answer is no. Very helpful. Yeah. I like that. I like her definitiveness with which she refuses to answer.
Well, some things are better left unexplained. But, right. You know, she is a helpful person, I would say. And we asked her who Clifton Webb was, and she did tell us. And it's right. The stage name of Webb Parmalee Hollenbeck, who is an early mid-20th century American actor. And she says, his manner is mimicked by the dog Mr. Peabody on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show.
Hello again, Peabody and Sherman here.
So there's some heavy, you know, cultural allusions here. It's much more complicated than you would have guessed.
And so, you know, what is this poem for? Well, she mentions in another Q&A that she works in a traumatic job at a police department. I believe it was a police department.
A victim's rights advocate.
Yeah, that's right. And so she's frequently encountering very raw events, and she makes these things as an escape from that. And and she thinks of it as collage with words. So instead of, you know, cigarette wrappers and things like that, she's using words. And I think one of the things, she doesn't mention this, but I think one of the things that's very appealing about these poems is, whether they're just funny, but one of the reasons they're funny is because it's a send-up of avant-garde poetry. It's like, it seems to be experimental poetry, but it's not. You know, she has no designs on you. She has no,
right.
It's just meant to make you smile.
There really aren't any tricks there, except you expect that there will be.
Here's another one, which I'll just read, and we needn't go into it. It's called Indian Winter. Why does Mama wear Indira's red and green earrings? A jinx is the inverse of Jewish artichoke. Kinship is the transverse of no opinion coke. Flambé is the reverse of Papa's poker chips. Touché to the universe of acquiescent lips. For the same reason she wears silent Nehru jacket. Holy Nehru jacket. That's the poem.
Perfect for the holidays.
Yeah. This is the first appearance of Eduardo Corral in poetry. Corral's first book, Slow Lightning, was selected by Carl Phillips as the 2011 winner of the Yale Series of Younger Poets competition.
We have two new poems of his in the December issue, both having to do with Robert Hayden, whom Corral calls one of his keystone poets.
Hayden was a gay, bisexual man, but he never acknowledged this in his lifetime. And me, nowadays, as a contemporary gay man, out and proud, I always struggle with that aspect of his life, that he himself felt his orientation was a sin.
The first poem is called To the Angel Beast. And the word angel beast comes from Hayden's Boneflower Elegy, which, as Hayden wanted, was published only after he died.
And in the end of this homoerotic poem, he calls upon the angel beast and the beast angel to basically tear him limb from limb because of the desires he feels.
Corral's poem is dedicated to Arthur Russell. Before he died in the early 1990s of AIDS, Russell was an openly gay composer and producer of 70s and 80s disco music.
But among a lot of music lovers, he's a cult figure for his solo recordings, and his songs are shot with sadness and tristeza. One of the iconic images of him is him holding this beautiful, beautiful cello and just looking out into the audience with this sadness in his eyes.
Here's Eduardo Corral reading To the Angel Beast.
All that glitters isn't music. Once, hidden in tall grass, I tossed fistfuls of dirt into the air, dough after dough of leaping. You said it was nothing but a trick of the light, goad, curves, goad, scarves. Am I not your animal? You'd wait in the orchard for hours to watch a deer break from the shadows. You said it was like lifting a cello out of its black case.
I love the end of that. I think
it's gorgeous.
Yeah, very striking comparison there.
It's haunting, and it's an image that has music in it too. It's sort of the embodiment of music, or how music is made, or what happens when the music lingers after the composer or musician are gone.
Yeah, even the sounds do. They're very subtle, but hours and deer, shadows and cello. They echo each other inexactly, beautifully.
You know, the opening line, "All that glitters isn't music," is going to remind readers of Shakespeare's "All that glisters is not gold," or Thomas Gray's "Ode on the Death of a Favorite Cat," and "Frost, nothing gold can stay." And we asked him if the poem takes anything from those particular poems, and Eduardo said that he knows and loves those lines, but that he's not consciously gesturing toward them.
Right.
You know, we're trained to read things into poems, and he says, no, it was actually something he misheard while he was sitting on a park bench. He was eavesdropping on a conversation between two elderly women, and they were talking about feet blisters.
Right. One said a dash of glitter is a must, right? And
yeah.
He heard all that glitters isn't music. And it makes me think of Akhmatova once said, the great Russian poet Anna Akhmatova once said that you have no idea the kind of shit that goes into making up poems.
This is the first one I know of with blisters in it.
Right. Right. You know, a corollary to that Akhmatova statement, she was joking, but poets often have no idea what their poems mean exactly either. Mm-hmm. You know, often they mean very different things or in different ways than the poet intended. And, you know, I'm struck by a lot of what Eduardo says about his poems. In this one, the sexual aspect of it is not nearly as overt as he may feel.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear the second poem from Eduardo Corral, because it's related to this one and may help us talk about it. This one is called "To Robert Hayden," in fact.
And the epigraph here is
"Less lonely, less,"
which comes from Hayden's poem, "The Mirages." Here's a slightly longer version of the quote. Less lonely then," the stranger said.
And this poem, as you might expect, imagines Hayden as a bit less lonely.
I invented an erotic encounter between Hayden and another man, but it's not a stranger, because it's obvious that these two have a prior relationship. I just imagine him having a moment in his life where he didn't detest or fear his desires.
There's a Spanish line in the poem, "Te acuerdas?" Do you remember?
In my mind, the other man in the room with Hayden is a Latino.
And he's also the speaker in the poem. So here's Eduardo Corral reading "To Robert Hayden."
"I gave you a tiny box. You lifted the lid, praised the usefulness of my gift, a silver pin shaped like an ampersand. As you fastened it to your lapel, I thought again of that motel outside of Chicago. ¿Te acuerdas? I sat on the edge of a bench, untied my shoes, face down, eyes shut. You breathed in the aroma of sweat and allspice coming off the sheets. I tossed my ring, gold inscribed, toward a pile of clothes. But the ring dropped in the small of your back, where it rattled and rattled like a coin in a beggar's cup."
So I remember when we first read this, we were confused. I remember I asked, so did he have an affair that we didn't know about? I didn't know all
right.
This about Robert Hayden, and I love his poems, but this was news to me, that what Eduardo says here very convincingly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't dispute it. But I remember wondering how we read this poem, right? Here's an imaginary affair with Hayden. And I remember thinking, well, this is a Q&A issue, so there's no danger of taking the poem because we'll get an explanation.
Right.
Right? But
yeah.
What if you didn't have that explanation? How would we read the poem then?
We've already been thinking about this poem for a long, long time. And I guess I probably will continue to think about it just because of that, even with the explanations that Eduardo gives, because there is something mysterious about that. I think it has to do with concealment, not wanting to conceal things, but having to conceal them. So the poem certainly reveals and conceals things. A striking image or figure for that is that silver pin shaped like an ampersand.
"As you fastened it to your lapel, I thought again of that motel outside of Chicago."
The poem sounds very straightforward, and yet it has very complex involutions. It talks about an ampersand, and there isn't an ampersand in the poem until the very end,
right,
where you have that ring. This is another thing that puzzled us for a while.
"But the ring dropped in the small of your back, where it rattled and rattled like a coin in a beggar's cup."
The "and" there is the ampersand. I think all this is intriguing. I like poems that make you think. I've probably said this before on our podcast, but, you know, Basil Bunting said, why should I understand everything in a poem? I think having to think about needing to conceal a sexual relationship or the larger questions about sexuality is the subject matter of the poem. It's just embodied in this. On the one hand, it's an imaginary love affair, but there's a real love affair behind it, which is Corral's love affair with Robert Hayden's poems.
That's an interesting way to read it. Yeah, that's true. And I guess the ampersand is meant to express some familiarity between these two people because the gift is of an ampersand, and ampersands were important to Hayden as well.
Mm-hmm. And then when we asked him about what the ampersand means to him, Eduardo said that Brenda Hillman once described the ampersand as a pregnant woman doing yoga.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah. He sees a pietà. There's so much in this poem, and I think reading it will give people a lot to see and think about.
This is also the first time in poetry for Alice Lyons, who lives in a small village of North Roscommon in Central Ireland.
Every day you encounter someone who says, that's not a local accent, you know, that's not a Roscommon accent. Where are you from?
Well, Lyons grew up in suburban New Jersey, and her mother took her to Ireland when she was a girl. She returned as a teenager when she was starting to write.
And when I came back here again as an adult, it's where I felt my future in writing lay. I don't feel like I could have written if I had stayed in the States in quite the same way. Just something about the place.
And like a lot of places, Ireland went through a real estate boom that started in the late 90s and lasted until the financial crash of 2008.
And in this small village alone, there's over 140 new holiday homes. Most of them are empty.
They call those places ghost estates. That's the situation addressed in her poem, Developers. Let's give it a listen.
Greed got in the way. We built a fake estate. Levinas said to see ourselves, we need each other, yet doorbells, rows of them, glow in the night village. A string of lit invitations no elbow has leaned into, both arms embracing messages. Unanswered, the doors are rotting from the bottom up. It's another perplexing pothole in our road, loves. Hardcore from the quarry might make it level. Hardcore and cunning speculation into matters concerning love and doubt, concerning want and plenty. Oh, the places where pavement runs out and ragwort springs up, where lindenwood ends but doesn't abut anywhere neatly, a petered out plot of tato tumbleweeds, bin bags, rebar, roof slates, offcuts, guttering, drain grills, doodads, infill, gravel. A not as yet nice establishment, possessing potential where we have no authorized voice but are oddly fitted out for the pain it takes to build bit by bit. When the last contractions brought us to the brink of our new predicament, we became developers.
That's interesting. You know, she reclaims that word at the end. We became developers, right? It's what the whole poem is, in a way, is a reclamation of land that's been abused, but it's also a reclamation of language. Mm-hmm. So that these words like speculation, even the word hardcore, which has its other uses, and then at the end, developers and contractions, mm-hmm. these become necessary things, and developers become something that we might evolve into.
Yeah.
Right? Different kind of developers, right?
Right. I guess you kind of make your choice there. Yeah. You know, the poem starts off, greed got in the way. We built a fake estate. And I think in a lot of ways, so much of English language poetry is about this, you know, about what I guess hundreds of years ago in British poetry would be called the common weal, you know, the health of the society, of the community. And this poem takes this head on. You know, the second line quotes a philosopher.
Levinas said to see ourselves, we need each other.
He's well known for exploring the ways in which people need each other. Mm-hmm. You don't really need each other, which involves being generous about the way in which people are different. And this is very much at odds, this way of needing people humanly is at odds with the kind of development of stuff for material reasons. So these are times when, I guess, you know, society starts to fall apart a little bit. She says,
"It's another perplexing pothole in our road, loves. Hardcore from the quarry might make it level. Hardcore and cunning speculation into matters concerning love and doubt, concerning want and plenty."
That's really moving.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just...
Instead of speculation into foreign currencies and, you know, and she also has these beautiful lines.
"A not as yet nice establishment, possessing potential where we have no authorized voice, but are oddly fitted out for the pain it takes to build bit by bit."
That slowness of development suits us, suits our humanity in some way.
Mm-hmm. And I was also thinking there, the authorized voice, I was thinking of the authorized version of the Bible, which mm-hmm. is also called the King James Version. Again, something that has so much impact even now on English language poetry, but we don't have that kind of authority in our lives. The authority has sort of been transferred to other kinds of institutions and people. And so, yeah, this is a poem of real reclamation.
Let's listen to another one. This one's called Reverse Immigration and has to do specifically with a plane trip to Ireland.
"If you fly Aer Lingus, the Irish national airline, the airline upholstery is handwriting. And it's become this kind of visual cliche for a nation's literary prowess. And so when you're staring at the back of the seat in front of you, you just sit there wondering, wonder whose handwriting that is. And all these thoughts are going through your mind when you're just sitting on the plane."
Here's Alice Lyons reading Reverse Immigration.
"When I boarded the plane, everyone looked like Uncle Tom. Ruddy. Some were empurpled. Gray hair or auburn, interior thatches. Pale blue of eye. A smidgen of resignation. The tribe. I thought, we are driving to the interior. I thought, holy God, the airline upholstery was Yates, Kavanaugh, and Heaney handwriting. I thought, holy shit, this is the maw. The maw."
You know, it's really true. If you fly Aer Lingus, you see the handwriting of these great Irish writers.
Oh, is that real?
Yeah, it's for real.
Really?
And, and you know, you're staring at this weird handwriting the whole time, and then it sort of dawns on you that you're looking at a reproduction of the handwriting of famous poets like Yeats and Kavanaugh and Heaney, and that they've been turned into sort of
marketing
tools that that Alice Lyons is trying to reclaim.
Yeah, as she says in her, they are marketing tools, but it's somehow heartening to have a nation proud of its literary culture.
Yeah, well, at first, it's you know, wouldn't happen here. We wouldn't
have,
you know, Walt Whitman on a seat back.
Right.
Hard to imagine. But then you start thinking about it, I guess, when you have nothing else to do and you're staring in front of you like that, and you just think, oh my goodness, where are we going with all this? What are these questions of travel, as Elizabeth Bishop would say? And in fact, when we asked her where the interior is to which these people in the poem are driving, Alice Lyons answers that she's referring to the last line of her favorite Elizabeth Bishop poem, Arrival at Santos, where you know, it says, "We leave Santos at once. We're driving to the interior."
Yeah.
It's such a powerful line. And it's very courageous of her to kind of hijack these lines and these words from other poems.
It's very much a poem about, well, you know, the title tells you what it's about. It's about returning, you know, going the other way. The Irish settled mm-hmm. in such numbers in America, and it's about going back to Ireland, and where everyone, you know, looks like Uncle Tom. Different connotation of Uncle Tom, and then
right,
she doesn't mean that.
Right. Yeah, it's her uncle, Tom, who owned a candy store in Hawthorne, New Jersey.
And has gray hair and auburn and terrier thatches, pale blue of eye, that kind of Uncle Tom. So it's that kind of return, but it's also, for her, very much a return to poetry, or mm-hmm. you know, claiming, you know, reclamation again of poetry. It's where she learned to write, and we asked her about these writers, Yeats, Kavanaugh, and Heaney. She was particularly close to Heaney, to his writing, and says it took her a while to unearth Yeats and Kavanaugh from their sort of official status mm-hmm. in Ireland. Yeah, I was intrigued by the end of the poem.
Holy shit, this is the maw. The maw.
The maw is almost always used to describe a voracious animal.
Mm-hmm.
There is this element of being devoured by what saves you at the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess it's kin to Eduardo's angel beast.
Yeah. Holy shit.
Yeah, yeah. Stephen Yenser is a poet and the director of creative writing at the University of California, Los Angeles. He first appeared in poetry in the early 1970s, and we've recently started getting his poems back into the magazine.
As Yenser told us, he's from Pennsylvania Dutch stock. His name is German, but if you're a Yiddish speaker, you might be offended just by hearing it, as Yenser learned only when he was in his 20s.
Actually, I was in graduate school, and I was talking to one of my professors, and he said something about my name, and I didn't know what he meant, and I asked him, and he said, Yenser, he said, it's a dirty word in Yiddish. It means fucker. And I said, oh, my God.
Actually, it means fucker in the sense of fornicator and not as in sort of you fucker. I guess that's a tiny distinction. It's a crucial one, I think, but, you know, it's not quite as bad.
What, you may be wondering, does this have to do with his poem in the December issue? Well, names and what they tell us are part and parcel of its subject. The poem is called Hijah for Emerson's Birthday.
Hijah is an Arabic term for a satire, a digressive, sometimes ribald satire.
Ralph Waldo Emerson's birthday is May 25th. On May 25th, 2004, as it happened, President George W. Bush said something at a ceremony that Yenser uses as an epigraph to this poem. Bush was speaking to an Iraqi citizen.
He says to him and to the crowd, "I'm honored to shake the hand of a brave Iraqi citizen who has had his hand cut off by Saddam Hussein."
Here's the first part of the poem where Yenser plays with that language and with some of the political language we heard during the Iraq War.
"Just ask yourself," we said back in those days, "is this world better off without Saddam Hussein?" Now that's a simple question. Just ask yourself. It turned up starkly, undeniably, as that left hand inside the trench Marines were digging at the prison-turned-facility. That was one day's headlined excavation. Meanwhile, the relics from the Tell Ner-Nasiriya were looted from the National Museum. Is our world better off without Saddam Hussein, who had cut off so many other hands? Our own president had grateful thousands on hand to honor him, give him a hand in D.C. on the birthday of the Sage of Concord. In other words, though, is this world better off without those who have made it better off? It's a bit of a riddle, really, how to tell. Each old hand among us has a hunch. Is our world better off without Bobby E. Beasley, Michael Yuri Tarlovsky, Craig W. Cherry, Yoder G. Reynoso, Joshua I. Bunch? These soldiers' names graced the obituary page that day in the L.A. Times. It's archived. Check it. But what can we tell from a name or measly obit? Just ask yourself.
So that was the first part of a much longer poem. We're going to hear other excerpts in just a minute. But it might help if we talk about it a little bit first and figure out how this poem works.
Well, there are lots of names in it.
Right.
You heard a few of them. There are many more to come.
It's a poem obsessed with naming and getting names right, although it does that. It sometimes seems by its, you know, names become very slippery. It slides from one thing to another almost before you can get your bearings.
Well, the first thing you want to do is find out who are these people. And he explains in the Q&A section that accompanies the poem in the issue that when he was reading the obituaries on the day that the president's comment was reported, he was just struck by this disparity between the specificity of using somebody's full name, including the, say, middle initial, and most readers, and this is a quote from him, most readers' incorrigible ignorance of the particulars of the lives lost, the lives of this person, exactly, precisely this person, going by this name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that life has ended, but who were these people? Who were they?
He was uncomfortable with using real names, and you can imagine it would have been easy to invent names to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why make them real? It's risky. But in the end, how can you write this poem without having real names?
Yeah.
How can you talk about these lives in this sort of ultimate context and make up the names?
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear another excerpt where Yenser goes deeper into the names and how they can seem to someone who only knows them from a newspaper obituary, as Don was saying.
Raymond J. Falstick, Jr., Kane M. Funk. What names people have. Stephen I. Yenser. What monikers, what handles for their children. Daniel Lee Galvin. Anyway, without them, mind you, we'd still have that butcher, Saddam Hussein. Wait, with them, you mean, we'd still have Saddam? Well, it can be perplexing when it's put like that. Bemusing, like the sound of one hand clapping, or one hand washing itself. Is our world better off without Roberto Abad? Abad, Roberto. What kind of name is that, in any case? Middle Eastern? And where's the middle initial? To tell him from his father, of course. A typo? For bad, Roberto A? Good is a good doctor, but bad is sometimes better. Emerson.
You begin to get a sense of the tone of this poem, and the tone is also risky. It seems sometimes as if he's taking all of these things very lightly. The poem skitters across these mm-hmm. things. It makes jokes. It makes jokes of people's names. As a reader, what you have to negotiate is how do you read this? Where's the kernel? Where's the because the poem is ultimately deeply serious, mm-hmm. what it's talking about.
Yeah, and deeply angry. It's
deeply
it's furious.
Angry. Right. I think that's what's so powerful about it is you have this fury which comes to you jokingly.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually much more effective than if it came to you as a shriek, which would seem just like just rhetorical.
Yeah.
You know?
His wit is savage, which reflects only a tiny aspect of the savagery of the war, of the politics. The poem is certainly designed to unseat us, to unsettle us, and it is relentless. It's a relentless poem.
And it's a poem about our ignorance. You know, we don't know the difference in the Sunnis and Shias. A lot of us don't. We don't. All these things get mingled up, and we're over there dropping bombs.
They get confused in our minds because our language, or at least the language that's used in political rhetoric, can be confused. It goes right back to Pound and Confucianism.
Right.
But, you know, when the language is messed up, everything's going to get messed up. And so this poem just messes with the language to really drive home that point.
Let's listen to the last part of the poem.
Or is it the rebellious, the disobedient, whose sister's brothers died on our side near Samara, without whom our world's mostly better off? It's hard to tell when they have veils. It's hard to tell when phantom limbs report again tomorrow just whom we're better off without. Yet ask yourself, can we contemn the vanity of false distinctions in light of presidential scripture? If thy right hand offend, we must cut Matthew off quick as RFK, alas, in order to go now to commercial. We're sorry, we're in the hands of the commercial. We leave you with this question. Would our world be better off without Iraq itself? Or what about your simple self? A little better, you must mean, or worse? And what about our own bull-headed liars, as Emerson might say? And the Milky Way, better off without this blue-green pearl of earth? Yet who could tell? And if no one could tell, what can we mean by tell? Now that's a simple question.
Well, that word tell has recurred throughout this poem. I mean, it was, in fact, early on, it was a tell, used as a noun, a tell in the Nasiriya. It was mm-hmm. a, you know, one of those mounds made up of layers of settlements. And it's the way these things get buried in language that this poem, you know, is about as well, the way one word contains so much. And he says, now that's a simple question at the end. Well, it's anything but a simple question.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, as he knows, as the poem knows, it's incredibly complicated.
Right. And it is really fighting back against what he calls in the Q&A preemptive responses and crude generalizations that can make a stone of the heart.
Mm-hmm. I was also struck by another thing he says at the end where he talks about Yeats. You know, Yeats said, you know, out of the quarrels with others we make rhetoric, and out of the quarrels with ourselves we can make poems. And he says, to the degree, Yenser says, to the degree that my own poem attacks a narrow political position, it has to be ephemeral.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
You don't hear too many poets avow that their work is ephemeral.
And for that reason, it's very striking. It's because it's narrowly political. Yeah. And it is narrowly political. It's complicated in its attack, but it's still quite obvious what it's attacking.
Yeah.
He says, because of that, it dooms the poem, because it's narrowly political. Do you think that's true?
I think there are poems like this that have a way of sticking around. When, you know, we were looking through some poems that had been published across 100 years of Poetry magazine, we ran across George Starbuck's great poem of the Vietnam War, where it has some naming in it, and it's about the fact that on the one hand, people were burning draft cards, but a draft protester, resistor, burned himself, set himself on fire. It was a poem of the immediate moment.
Addressed to Robert McNamara.
Yeah, directly addressed to McNamara. And that poem is still powerful and effective today and reminds us of the details that can be lost in the newspapers when they're sort of old and set aside or crumbled to dust. So who knows? I mean, this poem might serve for a long time as a reminder of the complexities of what we're up to.
You can read Stephen Yenser's poem as well as everything else that you've heard on this program in the December issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scheer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.